This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, the United States has tens of thousands of nuclear weapons, and North Korea only has a handful. But the U.S. claims that North Korea is the greatest danger to world peace. And author and historian Paul Street explains why Ta-Nehisi Coates has it in for the left.
But first, 15 Democratic U.S. senators have endorsed Bernie Sanders' Medicare for All legislation. In the House, a majority of Democrats have co-sponsored a single-payer health care bill. We spoke with Dr. Margaret Flowers, who works with a group called Health Over Profit.
I think it's an exciting moment that we have a Medicare for All bill in the Senate. That was a result of direct grassroots pressure to get that. And there are some positives in the bill in terms of creating a universal, you know, the intent is to create a universal Medicare for All system when it's fully implemented so that every person can get the medically necessary care that they need. Includes strong reproductive rights for women, which is great, and removes a lot of the cost sharing that keeps people from being able to get care, like co-pays. It does have some weaknesses, and we're working our way through it to understand what those are in terms of excluding long-term care, which a lot of people, you know, millions of people rely on. Also allowing investor-owned facilities to continue to operate in the system, and a very delayed kind of transition period over 4 years that sounds complicated and problematic. But Senator Sanders stated when he announced the bill that he was open to feedback from people. So I think it's a win for the movement, but it also underscores that we still have a lot of work to do and that we need to press to make the legislation better.
You say you're still studying the legislation. How much room does it appear it leaves for the operations of the private insurance sector?
Well, private insurance will be allowed to have a role as a supplementary to the system. So that is actually reassuring that it doesn't allow them to duplicate what the system provides. And it's not unusual in other systems to have supplementals. I think more concerning is the fact that providers and patients can opt out of the system and pay cash for services that the system covers. We need to make sure that we minimize that so we don't have like a parallel system for the wealthy. And then I think the big problem is that without removing the investor-owned for-profit incentive of facilities, this provides a huge cash cow to them so that they can just provide lots of services and build the government for it. So we need to work on ending that.
Cory Booker, the senator from New Jersey, and one other senator who say that they're for the Sanders bill, also voted against allowing the importation of much cheaper Canadian and other foreign prescription drugs.
Yeah, you know, we're not under any illusion that the Democrats who signed on to this legislation did it because they're strong believers in healthcare as a human right or, you know, a Medicare for All system. Really, the wave of sign-ons reflects where the popular kind of culture is going and how people are really fed up in this country with incremental approaches that have taken us nowhere and are saying we're spending enough for a national improved Medicare for All. Every other industrialized nation has a universal system and we want that system. So, you know, people are doing it because it's the politically appropriate thing to do or a popular thing to do. And it's up to us as activists to make sure that we continue to pressure all legislators to make this a reality.
Yes, even Cory Booker's tweet endorsing the Sanders bill sounds rather strange. He said he won't rest until every American has a basic security that comes with having access to affordable health care. And it sounds like he's talking about an Obama-type bill, using Obama-type language.
Yeah, and we're seeing that from a lot of the Democrats that they're saying, oh, I support health care for everyone, but let's look at all these different ways that we can do it. And And some are saying, you know, and a single-payer system is one way. It's why it's so important for us to understand what works and what doesn't, what's in the legislation and what isn't, because this is going to be a fight all the way through. You know, we have huge industries that are profiting greatly off of the current system, and they're not going to let go of that easily. But there is a shift change, you know, that's happening in the public, and there's momentum that's building, and so it's up to us to use that to get what we need.
And of course, the top Democrats, Senator Schumer and Congresswoman and House Democratic Leader Pelosi, have not endorsed this bill.
That's right. And there's a whole host of Democratic senators that haven't endorsed. People are looking at the fact that the ones that did endorse are ones that are in relatively safe districts. Also looking at the amount of money that many of our members of Congress have taken from the industry and wondering how much that influences their support. So, yeah, we still have a ways to go with this, and we know that this is a money-driven political system.
How has this influx of Democrats, this rather sudden influx of Democrats, changed the nature of the debate?
One thing I'd like to comment on is how it changed the bill, because what we're learning now is that Senator Sanders did make some compromises before he even submitted the legislation. We were pressuring him to make it stronger, and he made some compromises to make it weaker in order to have more support when he introduced it. Our letter to him and our, you know, message before he introduced it was start with a position of a strong bill and let the movement do the work of pushing their members of Congress to support it. But unfortunately, he did the opposite. But, you know, this is really showing that this is percolated into the Democratic Party, that this is something they're going to have to support. And again, I just can't underscore enough how important it is for us as a movement to watchdog that and make sure that they're held accountable and actually walking the walk instead of just talking the talk.
Yes, and in fact, even before this wave of endorsements, we had some Republicans who were making noises that sounded like an acceptance of the fact that Medicare for All or some form of single payer was an idea whose time had come.
Yeah, that's been an interesting development this year, the number of conservatives that are coming out and business leaders who are saying, you know, we just can't stay on the same path that we've been on in this country, that even some of the most capitalist countries have universal publicly financed health systems. And really, as a movement, we want to see bipartisan support for our final, you know, legislation when we win this system, because we don't want this to become a political tool that one party uses against the other. So we've seen some conservative Democrats sign on or show interest in the legislation. And we think when it comes down to it, we'll have Republican support as well. It's going to be one of those situations where the people kind of lead and create this wave, and the politicians are going to have to jump onto it if they want to.
One would think that the smaller business owners would be welcoming the prospect of single-payer health insurance, which would lift the burden from them.
Absolutely. It would go a long way to take a relief off their back. The National Federation of Independent Businesses reports that for small and medium-sized businesses in the U.S., healthcare costs are one of their greatest problems. And so it's exciting to see a new coalition of businesses called Business Leaders Transforming Healthcare that's coming together. And I think we'll see that grow over the years as more businesses learn that this is, you know, a possibility.
Not to mention the fact that the corporate media will now be forced to see single payer as a mainstream issue.
Yeah, single payer is definitely getting more attention in the corporate media. We're going to see both positive and negative. And what's been an interesting development in the last couple of months is progressives out in the commercial media saying, I support single payer, but it's too much. It's not politically feasible. We can get there some easier way. And so that's another area where we're going to have to be ready to counter that message. There's going to be attacks on all fronts to try to prevent us from going in this direction. And so if we're well-informed and persistent, we can win National Improved Medicare for All.
What's the next big campaign in light of these endorsements?
The next big campaign really is for people to push their members of Congress, if they haven't already signed on, to support National Improved Medicare for All in the House and in the Senate. We do have a record number of co-sponsors in the House, which is a good sign. And then to take those who have signed on and say, okay, Now you need to do more than just sign on to a bill. We want you to write about it in op-eds, to hold town halls on it, to speak about it in the media, to really start showing that this is something that you believe in. We want to see hearings in Congress that bring in witnesses to testify on these systems. So we really want to see movement on this, not just bills. People want to learn more and get involved. They need to check out Help Over Profit for Everyone. It's healthoverprofit.org, where we provide tools, information, ideas for doing outreach and action in their communities. And we have educational national calls every other week. So this is an issue that touches everybody, and it's something that no matter what you're working on, this is something that we ought to be coming together on to win, because it's going to, when we do win it, it's going to be a huge change in all of the work that we do, and finally saying that people are more important than corporate profits and that we all deserve the same access to the things that we need.
That was Dr. Margaret Flowers speaking from Baltimore.
The United States is by far the most heavily armed nation on the planet and has attacked more countries than anybody else since World War II. But Washington insists that North Korea is the biggest danger to the planet and has pressured the United Nations Security Council to impose harsh sanctions on the Koreans. UNAC, the United National Anti-War Coalition, opposes U.S. sanctions and threats against North Korea. Spokesperson Sarah Flounders explains.
These absolutely outrageous claims are really an effort to turn around what the whole world knows, and that is that the U.S. is threatening nuclear annihilation of Korea day in and day out. For example, the war games in August, the biggest all-time war games ever, and with nuclear overflights, nuclear-armed aircraft carriers, nuclear submarines, all directly aimed at the People's Democratic Republic, Korea, DPRK. This threat of nuclear annihilation against Korea has gone on ever since the Korean War. And the demand of People's Korea is sign a peace treaty and stop the threats. They also do say now, we refuse to be intimidated. And some of their statements are very worth hearing. I said, the time of dictating orders by brandishing U.S. military might has gone. Another one of their quotes back in April, when they launched one of their small, modest missiles, but they said, if those businessmen in power in the U.S. thought intimidating us by any military or sanctions threat, as the Obama administration used to do and failed, they will find such threats useless. So really what People's Korea is doing is saying in every way they can, we refuse to be intimidated. And they also are acknowledging that the very countries that did agree to disarm at U.S. demands in an effort to save themselves, such as Iraq and Libya, ended up absolutely in ruins, agreed to every U.S. demand, and certainly Libya did. And we see today the smoking ruin of a country that had the highest standard of living in Africa. So Korea is attempting to defend themselves with very modest missiles. And here you have the UN Security Council, the five permanent members, each of them a nuclear power in their own right, threatening People's Korea for developing as self-defense a tiny little nuclear weapons, which they feel at least will stop the nuclear threats or halt it and force a peace agreement. Now, it's important for us to see that this is really an oppressed nation, a country absolutely destroyed by U.S. war in the past, and surrounded and encircled now, asserting its right of existence.
Yes, one out of five Koreans died during the war. The United States has threatened Korea with nuclear weapons ever since that war. The U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff approved atomic bombing of North Korea during that war.
Complete annihilation is really what happened in Korea previously. And they say, looking at that And the country is united on this. And there's a real understanding in the South about the same thing, too. And we shouldn't assume, even though the media nonstop can lie day in and day out, one of the recent polls said 60% of the U.S. population, regardless of political affiliation, Republican or Democrat, support direct negotiations between the U.S. and the DPRK. That's amazing. I mean, it really even shows that the corporate media is not all-powerful. And in the minds of many people, this is an absolute war provocation being created from Washington.
And we have to point out that direct negotiation is exactly what the United States has refused to take part in and is the root of this crisis.
Exactly. That is all that Korea has called for, People's Korea has called for again and again, is negotiations, signing a peace agreement. And as a matter of fact, in the past, they made it absolutely clear that they would suspend nuclear weapons development if the U.S. stopped the nuclear threat. And the U.S. has refused to do that. They've refused on the grounds, as they say, that their nuclear weapons are legal and People's Korea's development is not. As if this is some sort of a legal discussion. But it's really the same thing. I mean, consider the U.S. threat and attempted coup and strangulation sanctions if Venezuela went ahead with an election, a constituent assembly, a representative body. They said if Venezuela dares to go ahead, they threatened absolute destruction, Venezuela went ahead. Or we could look at the demand in Syria for 6 years that the entire government of Syria must resign, must step down, and a government handpicked by the imperialists, U.S. and European, should come to power. The government and the people resisted, and a third of the population was displaced or refugees, much of Syria in ruins. But they stood up to the U.S. demand that they completely capitulate. So we're really seeing a time of growing resistance to U.S. plans and a determination not just to allow. I mean, when you look at Trump's threats, where he said fire and fury like the world has never seen, that's how he threatened People's Korea. Talk about a threat of preemptive nuclear strike and raising the stakes.
And we must remember that President Obama initiated a $1 trillion nuclear weapons modernization drive, which, of course, President Trump is continuing.
That's right. And even just recently, the largest all-time military budget in U.S. and world history passed all but unanimously, overwhelmingly, by the Democrats and the Republicans, along with sanctions threats on People's Korea, on Iran, Russia. Overwhelmingly, every Democrat voted for it, along with the Republicans. So this is a time when there is, in the ruling circles, absolutely consensus to threaten every country on the face of the earth with sanctions, with nuclear annihilation, with constant war threats surrounding U.S. aircraft carriers really plow the oceans, 1,000 military bases. But I wanted to also use this as an opportunity to just discuss, if I could, a bit about a Department of Defense study called At Our Own Peril. And it's a product of a year-long U.S. Army War College research effort. And it had the participation of the military think tanks and the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And what they said is that there's a fundamental change underway. And they're the ones who declare it, that the U.S. empire is collapsing. So I wanted to just use some of their quotes, because they're talking about what they use the term post-U.S. primacy environment.
As if the United States has already passed that point of primacy.
That's right. That's what they are saying, that global events, this is a quote, are happening faster than the Department of Defense can handle, and they're being outpaced by world events. They say the global order the U.S. built for the past 7 decades is under enormous stress, and the U.S. can no longer count on its unassailable position of dominance, supremacy, or preeminence, nor can they rely on the dominance they enjoyed for 20-plus years after the collapse of the Soviet Union. So they are looking at these ability to make threats and for countries to say, no, we will not collapse or surrender in the face of these threats. By the way, one of the other things about this U.S. Army War College report is it says one of the biggest threats they face is the uncontrolled spread of information, that the Pentagon can no longer rely on secrecy and operational security.
But it certainly can spread disinformation. And even though its threats may have less effect than in the past, it does not discourage them from making these global threats.
Well, that's what's most interesting about this report. They both categorize where they're at, that there's a generalized disintegration of traditional authority structures, that there's too much access to information, that there's a hyperconnectivity in the world today. Then they talk about what this means and what they're going to do about it. And the only thing they can come up with is expanding the U.S. military. That's their only option. Invest in more surveillance, improve propaganda, larger, more flexible U.S. military, weaponization of information and disinformation. That's a term they use. They have to engage in the weaponization of information and disinformation, and that the U.S. and its partners must have unimpeded access globally, air, sea, space, and cyberspace, in order to maintain global access to resources. So they're both talking about the collapse they're facing and saying that they are united in upping the ante. And this is why Congress votes all but unanimously for an even largest in history, military budget and new sanctions. They're reading these same reports and reaching the same conclusions. So we have a both greater danger, but we do also need to stand with the countries that are risking everything to resist U.S. demands. That is true for Korea today.
The people who wrote that report seem to agree with you and I that imperialism has only one card left to play, and that is the military.
And that is the military. And yet, can they do that? Yes, they can incinerate the world. But it doesn't mean that they can win in Afghanistan. Isn't that incredible? I mean, what a contradiction. And their solution is more troops to Afghanistan, longest war in U.S. history against the poorest country on the face of the earth. So the situation is becoming really impossibly contradictory.
Well, the Trump administration is acting as if it somehow holds some kind of economic card that it can play with China over this so-called Korean crisis.
Well, that's what's most interesting, because they admit they have lost their economic dominance. That's really what they mean by post-U.S. primacy environment. They have lost the position they once held as the economic superpower, able to call the shots all around the world. And it's true, especially for China, also for Russia, in solidarity, they shouldn't pass these sanctions resolutions against Korea. But it also is significant that China hasn't actually implemented the sanctions resolution and continues to give People's Korea vital fuel and supplies. I don't want to speculate on their reasoning behind it, but it seems that they fear once war is launched by the U.S., it would be far more dangerous. So they vote the resolutions as a way of forestalling military action. Perhaps that's what's involved. It's hard to know.
But could the United States, would the real rulers of the United States, the folks with the money, tolerate a kind of economic warfare with China, in which they have vast investments?
Well, that's part of the contradiction. As a matter of fact, the threat of sanctions on Russia and Iran brought howls from the imperialist collaborators who have supported sanctions, all forms of sanctions in the past, against other developing countries such as Iraq and Syria, went right along with it. But now suddenly, why they're backing up and saying, why, this isn't legal. How can you do this? This impacts us. So whether the U.S. can carry out the threats, even because corporate power in the U.S. needs those relations with China, and do they want to see that ended? It's a very contradictory who has the upper hand in this and what options they use. This idea that they're going to threaten Russia. Now Russia is not a superpower any longer. We need to rethink that. The GDP of Russia is smaller than South Korea. And in great part, that's why the U.S. thinks they can make these threats, because they want complete access to every part of the world, and they want complete access particularly to the countries that have huge resources, which is true for Iraq and Iran and Russia and Syria, and of course to China too, China especially.
But if we are in a post-U.S. dominance phase, as that report you referred to seems to say, the lords of empire can go crazy seeing their own end in sight.
That's what makes this so dangerous. And it's also why it's so important that the voices right here at home speak out and link these struggles together. The racism and the threats right here at home, and the unending cuts. I mean, they all want to give away everything to the super rich in terms of taxes. And at the same time, we're the only industrialized country without a health plan that's even reasonable. And the level of racism, it's like the war threats abroad. That's their only solution. Increasingly try to rely on racist white supremacist forces here at home and mercenaries and the most reactionary forces all around the world. It's not succeeding anywhere because there's levels of resistance that are growing. So I think the situation is very grim, extremely dangerous, and yet at the same time, the only option is increased solidarity and increased defense of every kind of resistance. That's like the only weapon we have, and yet political consciousness is a very powerful weapon.
That was Sarah Flounders of the United National Anti-War Coalition.
Ta-Nehisi Coates, the black writer for the neoliberal magazine The Atlantic, has blasted what he calls the left for favoring class arguments over racial realities. The charge drew a quick response from author and historian Paul Street, writing in Counterpunch.
I never even know what people mean half the time when they say the left. It's kind of amusing to me. But yeah, he throws that phrase around a lot. He says the left. He says the modern left. He says leftist. Now, when you read this essay, his definition of the modern left is kind of absurd. I mean, it includes people who aren't even remotely left at all, like vanguard arch neoliberals like Bill and Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama. I mean, Hillary Clinton, who said during the 90s that she was proud to have been a Goldwater girl, right, and then explained to NPR that she thought that the right-wing Republicans of her time had betrayed the conservative cause that she grew up with. And he, Ta-Nehisi Coates, has leading, you know, sort of neoliberal pundits like Nicholas Kristof of the New York Times, George Packer of the New Yorker in there, and of the leftmost extreme that Coates can even imagine. Of course, Coates' essay is all about electoral politics. He does, you know, pretty much. He doesn't seem to know about movement leftists or people actually involved in social movements. Coates is sort of obsessed with candidates. And sort of the ultimate leftist, I guess, for him is Bernie Sanders. And for a lot of us on the actual left, the historical, actual capital L left, didn't find Bernie all that particularly radical at all. But that's your leftmost left for Ta-Nehisi Coates.
His charge seems to be that this left that he invents places class over race or even ignores race. And yet he seems to ignore class entirely.
Well, first of all, I don't even know what lefty's talking about. Now, Sanders said some things that I thought were kind of problematic about pushing reparations completely to the side and sort of the way he dismissed identity politics. I don't think it's class politics versus identity politics. I think it's a bourgeois neoliberal version of Machiavellian ruling class divide and rule identity politics versus how the left, how the Marxist left, the radical left, handles identity. I think identity matters. I think there's very specific forms of experience and oppression to different racial ethnic groups, and certainly to Black America. Sanders said a few things like that, but most of the leftists that I've known up to this day, and pretty much for all my life, tended to be pretty into and about racial justice. And right now, leftists of various stripes are all about Black Lives Matter. They're about opposition to racist mass incarceration and racist policing. They're against the Confederate statues. They don't like the Confederate flag. They don't like segregated schools. They don't like the skill and drill, the highly segregated, noxious curriculum that's imposed on Black children in inner city schools and all that kind of stuff. So I don't know why he's trashing the left on that issue, particularly when leftists of many colors, including white leftists, brown leftists, all kinds of multicultural leftists were just involved in rather heroic activities down in Charlottesville and marching against the Confederate statues. And, I mean, you even had these guys, these redneck revolt guys guarding the perimeter armed to protect these civil rights marchers in Charlottesville against neo-Nazi and neo-fascist attacks. So, the timing of going after the left and claiming that all it cares about is class and not race is just wrong. And the left that I've always understood, the left that I've always been part of, the left that I got interested in intellectually, politically, socially, many decades ago, going back to the days of reading W.E. Du Bois, C.L.R. James, and Oliver Cox, and some white left historians like David Roediger and all that, but it was always a group of people who combined opposition to racism and classism in the same analysis. I mean, people for whom race, and you couldn't understand race completely in this country without understanding class, and who also said you can't understand class completely in this country without understanding race. In other words, people who see race and class as sort of dialectically inseparable, inextricably linked oppression structures and all that. And the coach just doesn't seem to know about this left at all. I can't tell whether he knows it exists and he just doesn't care about it because he wants to dismiss it because he's taking money from the MacArthur Foundation and has a privileged job at the corporate neoliberal Atlantic. I can't tell if he's just a sort of a cynical fool about that or if he's just a fool. He's a smart, brilliant writer in a lot of ways, but I can't tell from his writing whether he just is so blinded by his sort of bourgeois version of identitarianism that he just doesn't pay attention to all those writers and to that combined race-class analysis that's always been part of the left. Now, it's interesting that in this article and in his book last year, he likes to quote from Roediger, but he quotes him in a very one-dimensional way. He only quotes the part of Roediger that talks about how the white working class is racist, and he never seems to really quote or understand the part of Roediger or other Marxist historians who talk about how race has always been used as a top-down divide-and-conquer strategy by the capitalist elite in American history. And this goes back to the beginning. This goes back to the 17th century in Virginia. People who talked about the very interesting and repeated and recurrent and sort of inspiring moments of Black and white working-class solidarity, going back to 17th century Virginia all the way up through the rise of the CIO and the left-led labor unions in the 1930s and the 1940s, and he just never seems to mention that. I don't know if he knows about it, or my guess is he knows about it and doesn't care because he's playing a game here.
Well, certainly a genuine leftist understands that the fight against racial oppression cannot be successful unless there is transformation of the total society, economically, politically, socially.
Which is certainly the conclusion that quite stridently and passionately and eloquently Dr. Martin Luther King had certainly come to. I think in a lot of ways people don't know how much King was already there, even as a young man, but he came out quite openly in his speeches and writings, pretty much saying what you just said. By 1965 on, this was just a recurrent theme in Dr. King's writings. Of course, Dr. King was a democratic socialist. There's another guy that Coates likes to quote a lot without giving you any sense whatsoever of how left and how radical really a democratic socialist, Dr. King was. In fact, Dr. King was an anti-imperialist and a socialist and an opponent of class inequality in many ways, every bit as much as he was a civil rights activist on behalf of Black America.
And Coates attacks this left, an invention of his own, and winds up supporting the right wing of the Democratic Party, personified by Hillary Clinton and by Barack Obama.
You know, it's by and large he does. Now, you know, I'll give Coates a little bit of credit in that he sort of continues to make reference to some of the issues he had with Obama along the way, which was, you know, Coates was kind of pissed off because Obama, I mean, he's right about this. Obama was ridiculously reluctant to raise the issue of racially specific racial oppression in America because, you know, of course, Obama was afraid of alienating too many white voters and blah, blah, blah. You know, Obama knew how he got in office in the first place. He wasn't going to mess with that. So, you know, Coates has a little bit of that. Coates, in his essay, also mentions the racism of back in the 90s, the Ricky Ray Rector stuff and the assault on welfare. Maybe I'm giving him too much credit. I think he mentioned the three strikes criminal justice bill that the Clintons came through. You know, listeners who really want to see a really good primer on the racism, the deeply embedded racism of the Clintons, should read Elaine Brown's marvelous book, The Condemnation of Little B. So he coached us a little bit of it, but now he's been enlisted somehow this year, I think, in a kind of right-wing corporate democratic hit job against the Sanders wing of the Democratic Party. He's doing everything he can to discredit democratic socialism and sort of the left progressive tendencies that are threatening the corporate elites atop the Democratic Party. And so you hear things from him in this essay like there's this applause and praise for Obama allegedly delivering, I think this is the phrase in Coates' essay, delivering on the ancient liberal goal of national health care. That's what he says. He gives Obama credit for delivering on the ancient liberal goal of national health care with no sense whatsoever that in many ways the longstanding 20th century liberal version of health care reform, insurance, by the way, not health care, that the liberal goal historically, this goes back to Harry Truman, was actually Medicare for all. That's what historically, when I was a kid, listening to my grandfather who was involved in the war on poverty, that's what health care reform was. And it got pushed over to the right into this neoliberal thing that Obama passed called the Affordable Care Act, which was a bill written by the right-wing Heritage Foundation and first tested under the Republican Governor Mitt Romney in Massachusetts, and which leaves the insurance companies in full profit-making power, is plagued by ridiculously high premiums, leaves millions of people without health care. So, you know, that's just kind of reach there. Now, I mean, you know, you got to be careful about that because there were some expansions of Medicaid and things of that nature. But to call that the ancient goal of the achievement of the ancient goal of national health care is really a bit much. And he also has some line in here about Hillary Clinton, that she went as far as any modern politico has gone. I mean, that would rule out like all of the seriously left candidates, right, you know, of our lifetimes, right? But all he cares about is major party candidate. So she went as far as any of them in acknowledging systemic underlying racial oppression, which seems like a pretty weak statement in light of her rather awful history on race. And I'm really not even sure it's true. People ought to go back and take a look at John Edwards' statements in the presidential debates in early 2008 in the primaries in South Carolina, and he just sort of blew the roof off with statistics and ripping reflections on how deeply embedded racial inequality was in America. I've never heard Hillary go off on race anywhere remotely close to what Edwards did at that time. And besides which, who cares? He's so focused on electoral politics and candidates. It's just ridiculous. Who gives a damn what they say, really, because these candidates don't mean, you know, 99.8% of the things they say. And if we're going to have any real kind of solutions to racial and class oppression in this country, they sure as hell aren't going to come from Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders or Jill Stein. They're going to come from social movements. They're going to come from the kinds of movements we've had historically and we've had to some extent still up to this day that he seems to know nothing about. It's probably kind of hard to keep track of them when you're in Paris. I don't know if he's still in Paris, but he's been a lot of last year hanging out with rich people in Paris with the MacArthur Foundation Genius Grant that he got. It's one of the kinds of things you get when you're really eloquent and smart at saying kind of reactionary things to put the left in their place.
What upsets me is that the charges that he makes against this left that he's invented in his own mind, charge that this left panders to white people, is actually true of the people he supports and praises, like Hillary Clinton. During the campaign, Clinton's operatives were openly saying that they would trade off any votes that they lost to Sanders, any votes on the left, for the ones that they would gain from the white suburbs and among Republicans who were upset with Trump.
Oh, I don't think there's any doubt about that whatsoever, yeah. And that's very consistent with the Clinton strategy back in 07 and 08, in her earlier failure, which was just sort of openly racist. And actually, Coates mentions a little bit of that, about how racist the Clintons' people were back in that day. The notion that Hillary Clinton has somehow become some sort of committed anti-racist, that is just utterly and completely preposterous. The notion that she's any better on race than Bernie Sanders was is also something that I find, you know, extremely and highly suspect. Coates does play some sort of nasty word games with Sanders in this essay, and I think that deserves mention too. I mean, he really overreaches with Sanders. I mean, Sanders, I had a lot of issues with Sanders, particularly on defense, but Pentagon system and the empire. I thought Sanders handled race badly. I thought he was very ham-fisted to dealing with the black electorate, and I think that sort of was a factor in his defeat. But I mean, actually, Sanders was a sincere civil rights activist when he was a young man at the University of Chicago in the early 1960s. And Sanders is advancing some programs that I actually think, like single-payer insurance and big green jobs programs and some other anti-poverty measures, that actually would have had a fairly disproportionately good impact on poor people of color, things that Hillary wasn't advancing at all. And I think Sanders sort of understood something that I don't think Coates, he's just not willing to acknowledge it, and that is that the racial divide and rule strategies that have been practiced by the ruling class in this country from the beginning, the white supremacism, Coates is right that the Trump phenomena is an expression of a really brutal, vicious, tribal, white racist nationalism. And I open my essay saying I think with a lot of sort of praise for his statements about the Trump phenomenon and the fact that the Trump phenomenon is a cross-class, multi-class white phenomenon and coalition, not just supposedly the rebellion of the great white working class. It's really not true. That's not really what the Trump phenomenon was. But Coates seems to be completely unwilling to acknowledge that racism has victimized the white working class and poor whites, as well as having victimized, obviously, black and Latino and Native American populations. Historically, it's been a very bitter poison kind of thing for the white working class. It's worked against their ability to join in solidarity with workers of color to actually, you know, form movements that might take on the ruling class, the bourgeoisie. It's been a sort of It's been a very weak compensation for their own now dramatically declining status in American society. I think Sir Sanders understood that, and Coates just is completely unwilling to admit that.
When Ta-Nehisi Coates talks about the left, he clearly is talking about white people, although I don't think that most of the folks in this country who are genuinely left are white. He, in fact, is disrespecting the black left.
Oh, yeah, the black left just can absolutely invisible to him. You know, I say at the end of this essay, too, didn't anybody at Howard University, where Coates went to school, ever make him read W.E.B. Du Bois? Anybody ever make him read the forgotten great black Marxist sociologist Oliver Cox or C.L.R. James, or really carefully read the writings and speeches, for that matter, of Dr. Martin Luther King? I mean, these are black left socialists, and they exist, and there's a whole bunch of them, and they've always had a dialectical analysis of the relationship between race and class. And empire, I might add, too. In fact, those are Dr. King's three triple evils, right? They were interrelated. Imperialism, capitalism, racism. They overlap and interweave in all kinds of darkly fascinating ways.
That was writer and historian Paul Streak.
A new poll commissioned by the American Federation of Teachers Union shows that public school parents care most of all about adequate funding for education, and that large majorities think there's too much time and attention paid to high-stakes testing. We spoke with Dr. Monty Neal, executive director of the Fair Test Organization in Boston, and asked why only 11% of parents think that so-called school choice is an important issue.
It's clearly nowhere near as important to most people as things like funding or the amount of testing now. There are parents who want and seek charter schools. There are some in the general public who do, but it's certainly not a majority goal. And most people in most places like and want to preserve and improve their public schools. They are aware that testing now is hurting, not helping their schools, and that has made them resistant to all the testing that's going on.
And, of course, the focus of the charterization people has been Black and Hispanic communities. But this poll shows that majorities of both Black and Hispanic parents say that there's been too much attention to standardized testing.
Yes, that's correct. We've seen in that and in other polls that have broken out data by race that majorities of Black and Latino people are aware of and concerned about the overuse and misuse of tests. In many of the cases, the numbers aren't quite as strong as they are for white folks, but still majorities are agreeing with Fair Test that we really need to cut back all of this testing mania.
Then why don't we see this reflected in the debate that goes on in corporate media around standardized testing and school charterization?
Well, the data may appear in the media some, but it seems that the ideology of testing has heavily influenced the media and even more heavily influenced policymakers. They are responding to corporate pushes. The corporations continue in general to support lots of testing and high-stakes testing. They do that at the national and state level through organizations like the Business Roundtable and the Chamber of Commerce, and state branches of them. We were just here testifying in Massachusetts at the legislature earlier in the week, and the only people defending the tests seems to be the Chamber of Commerce. But you had parents, students, teachers, all testifying along with other folks, advocates of like Fair Test, all explaining through data and stories what's wrong with this picture. I'd say we got more interesting questions from members of the committee, particularly the co-chairs, but their mindset is still trapped in the testing mindset. And we think it's going to take a lot of political work to get them to change their minds. It is not a matter of the data. It's not even a matter of the data shown by polls anymore. It's going to take the parents and the students going into the offices and having those conversations and whatever else with the representatives to get them to change their mind. At the federal level, the same kind of pressure has to be brought. We helped with many others in organizing a lot of pressure on Congress to drop the amount of mandated testing in the federal law. We did not succeed, despite all of the data we had not that long ago, which wasn't that different from what the AFT poll showed. We did manage to win a good deal on accountability. They really cut back the damage, but not on the amount of testing. So that continues to be a major problem across the country. We see some states willing to try to cut back and put caps on testing. The caps are still too generous, like Maryland just put a 2.2% cap on the time spent on testing. That's really more than double what it should be, if not more than even than that. But it's still showing some progress. In this case, in Maryland, against the local school districts, the local superintendents who want a free hand with testing. But we're seeing districts beginning to cut back testing. Santa Fe and Las Cruces, New Mexico, Sacramento and San Diego, California, St. Paul, Minnesota are among districts that have either completely eliminated all the district mandated tests or sharply reduced those tests.
Some of us saw this mania for testing taking shape in big business circles back in the 80s, but it's swept through the Democratic Party as a mechanism to increase charterization, which reached new heights under an Obama administration.
Yes, that's true. Certainly there was a push, particularly for high school graduation tests that big business made mainly in southern states in the 1980s and 90s. Recently, the number of states with graduation tests over the past decade has declined from 26 to 13, so that's a good sign. The Democrats, I think, were going for two things. One, along with the Republicans, the promotion of charters. They also saw the tests, incorrectly in our view, as a tool to expose inequity and inadequacy in education. To some extent, that happened. The problem is the tool is an extremely dangerous and harmful tool. And the law has done nothing to say, what do you do that's good after you expose problems? The major problem is a lack of funding. It hasn't solved that problem, certainly not from the federal government, nor from the states, which are, on average, spending less now than they did before the 2008-09 recession. So the issues that supposedly all the testing was going to expose have not been addressed. And meanwhile, the testing is causing great damage to teaching and learning on the part of the kids. And when there are high stakes attached, it's damaging the life prospects of students, it's damaging teachers' careers, and it's damaging schools that are being closed and in some cases turned over to charter schools.
And the issue of community control of schools has virtually disappeared from the political scene in many places.
It seems it's having a tough one. It's interesting. When in Massachusetts this past November, a whole array of organizations came together, civic organizations, the unions, civil rights groups, in opposition to a plan to raise the cap on charter schools in the state of Massachusetts. When the campaign started in the spring, we were behind 60 to 40. We won 62 to 38. And the largest margin of victory that may have occurred in the whole state, but certainly up among them, was in the community of Roxbury in Boston, which is a heavily Black and Latino neighborhood. So that's more evidence that these communities, when they have the conversation, which they had not had, about the impact of all of this on their schools, they step up. Across the state, we found that the key issues were the loss of money to schools when the charters open and the loss of local control. So local control remains a big issue in Massachusetts. It does in some places. In others, it does not. Unfortunately, Boston, we have local control, except it's mayoral control. We don't have an elected school board anymore. We're the only city in the state that does. And there's certainly other big cities that have lost control over their schools due to state law and state interventions. So that's an issue. But yeah, the local control story is really important. Of course, we know that sometimes historically local control has been very bad for poor people and people of color. So one has to think about how to have local control, but to have the kind of democratic controls over local control so as to inhibit, block, and overcome the built-in structural inequities that we see at the local levels, but as well, of course, at the state and federal levels.
What many of us have observed is that local control is seen as fine until large supermajorities of Black and brown students make up the public school system. And then one talks about state control.
Yeah, we've certainly seen that happen. Or you go to mayoral control, so that really the problem with mayoral control is that people elect a mayor based on a whole bunch of different issues. And a lot of people's schools aren't a big issue. They don't have any kids in the school. So you get an elected mayor who doesn't really care that. I mean, you look at Chicago, the guy, Rahm Emanuel, he's attacked the public schools. He supports destroying the public school system financially and through charter schools. But, you know, most of the people in Chicago don't have kids in the school. And so people are voting on a set of other issues, not really the schools. If you have an elected school committee, that's the issue. Schools, and you're apt to get potentially, not always, a better school committee. Of course, we've seen hedge funders and such fund get involved in local and state school board races to try to win pro-privatization, protest people on the boards. But this is a big issue in the cities where people, a lot of parents and activists and union people and so on, they really want to go back to having an elected school board. So sometimes it's the state, like New Jersey, taking over districts like they took over Newark, heavily Black and brown. Sometimes it's mayoral control, but it's done because by the state in part, like in Massachusetts, to get mayoral control in Boston, the state legislature had to approve it. And yes, it's taking away decision-making capacity from Black and brown people, absolutely. I had one other thing. You know, we saw I mentioned that the states that were first at using high-stakes tests as a graduation requirement were southern states, and those are states with very large black populations. The next batch of states were northern industrial states with large black populations. The third batch of states were the southwestern states with large, mainly Latino populations, and then some others added on. So our analysis is there's been a racial dimension to the imposition of graduation tests on high school students. And it's likely a sign of the growing power, such as in California, that they've had to drop those tests. You know, we can't say for certain that's the case. But that's one of the reasons we believe that in California, certainly, that the growing power of the Latino population has helped the legislature see the wisdom of ending the graduation tests.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host, Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.